Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History. Shuswap Sleigh Ride. This story was inspired after our family experienced one of the nicest winter outings at Blackburn's. The night was busy with other folks, like ourselves, lining up in turn to enjoy a festive sleigh ride. Here we go. The night was crisp and clear. Rising steam wafted off the backs of two Belgian horses waiting patiently in ankle-deep snow. Groups of family and friends chattered excitedly, eager to begin their ride aboard the long wooden sleigh hitched to the team. A gas lamp hung from an overhead bar midway down the sleigh, illuminating two long rows of seats, which stretched from the driver at the front to where passengers boarded at the back. Fresh-smelling cedar boughs decorated the frame top of the sleigh, and hay lay on the floor. Two children, caught up in the excitement, strained in opposite directions at their mother's hands. Smiling grandparents surrounded by children and grandchildren reminded me of a gaggle of geese gearing up for an outing. Soon the driver shouted, "All aboard!" and we 25 revelers scrambled in to fill our seats. Clothed in warm, bulky winter wear, we tucked blankets around our legs and feet. Only our bare faces were exposed to the elements. At the snap of the reins and a shout, we were off! The large horses pranced through field and forest, exhaling great breath clouds past the driver's station. Many of the passengers snuggled down, trying to block out the chilly night wind blowing off Shuswap Lake. A tape deck playing Christmas carols enticed us, until one by one, the entire group was singing at the top of their lungs. At one point, the sleigh's route paralleled the railway tracks. As luck would have it, a lighted passenger train sped by us, blaring its horn. We waved and shouted back. Over the rutted paths we bumped, the cold wind and darkness rushing upon us. As passengers, we didn't know where we were going, but those massive horses surely did. Rounding a bend, we saw a huge bonfire with a crowd of happy people circled around it. They seemed reluctant to leave that warm setting and board our sleigh as we disembarked. Hot chocolate and steaming buttered popcorn were promptly offered to us by smiling ranch hands as we gathered around the fire. Some of us even roasted marshmallows. The half hour sped by so quickly. When we heard the familiar sleigh bells draw near again, we were reminded that this special part of Christmas was almost over. The horses must have sensed it too, for after we boarded, they took off with such vigor, we had to hold on tightly to the wooden seats. With increasing speed, the sleigh whipped around the bends and over bumps, despite the driver shouting, "Whoa, whoa," and trying to rein in the team. In no time, we had come full circle, back to our original destination. It must have been the magic of the sleigh bells as they jingled with each pull of the horses that instilled a sense of kinship amongst us. As we stepped from the sleigh, we were like old acquaintances, suddenly reunited, shaking hands and wishing each other a very Merry Christmas. To each of us, this ride had taken on a different meaning, which we would carry inside of us forever. With waving of hands, we all departed, vowing to return next year for another Shuswap sleigh ride.
The History of the Salmon Arms Seventh-day Adventist Church by Rosalind Fair. The Salmon Arms Seventh-day Adventist Church began with a small group of believers. At the time, there was a church in Silver Creek and also a small company in the Tappan-White Lake area. However, it appeared that there was also a need for an organized church closer to Salmon Arm where people could worship together on the Sabbath. In 1972, the Presbyterian Church on 3rd Street Northeast was rented. It is now a private residence. The first recorded services were held at that location on February 19, 1972. Pastor Bob Tates traveled from Vernon to give the sermon. Tithes and offerings were collected and sent to the conference. Denise Ekstad purchased a visitor book and happily asked those who came to sign the book. There were many visitors and pastors from the surrounding areas. Little by little, more people attended, and a core group met each Sabbath, singing and praising the Lord for the blessings of worshiping together. In the winter months, Denise Ekstad and her two youngest daughters would arrive early and light the wood stove so that the church would warm up before people arrived. Also, since it started as such a small group, many weeks members of the congregation took part in some capacity in the running of the Sabbath school and church service. As the group grew in numbers, the need for a different location arose. The company moved to the Lutheran Church on Broadview. Emil Selsley and his first wife, Grace, moved to Salmon Arm and purchased property near the corner of Lakeshore Road and Park Hill Drive. They were impressed to donate part of the property to facilitate the building of the new church. An application for the necessary permit was submitted to council in 1976. After many months of volunteer work and numerous hours of labor together with lots of prayer, the Salmon Arm Seventh-day Adventist Church was ready for the first services. An article in the local paper at the time, the Salmon Arm Observer, reported the first services in the new Seventh-day Adventist Church were held on Christmas Day, December 25, 1976. Many people have been greatly touched by the members of this church, both past and present. This church continues to be a light in the community. With God, all things are possible, even a little country church which developed from a dream into a reality. May we all continue to thank the Lord for the many blessings bestowed upon each one of us.
Bobsledding in 1947. In 2005, our writers group decided to help celebrate Salmon Arm's 100th birthday by sponsoring a writing contest for the best historical story. The first and second stories would then be published in the annual Okanagan Historical Society book, report number 69 for that year. My husband Ken, who grew up here in Salmon Arm for most of his life, told me about a sleigh riding incident, and I encouraged him to enter his story into the contest. With help from me and editor friends, he won second prize. Come close to your radio now. You won't want to miss a word. 1, 2, 3, go! Our two homemade bobsleds, manned by four boys on each sled, pushed off into the murky winter's night, down North Broadview Road. The rough gravel road was now covered with a thick layer of ice that had built up over the weeks, and tonight it was home to a deadly, slippery surface. Sparks flew in the darkness as the metal blades on wooden runners scraped across an occasional exposure of gravel. Otherwise, there was little resistance on this veneer-like surface. A lone flashlight tied to one sled lit the path for the two sleighs. Our sleigh had no light, and our vision was very limited. We boys had set up some rules. If a car came, we would steer toward the bank and all drag our boots to slow the sled. If it seemed impossible to stop, we headed for the snowbank. If a pedestrian was walking up the road, we would yell a warning at the top of our voices and simply steer to the other side. Tonight's race started from McKay's, close to the Elks Park, and was supposed to end at the dip near the high school. However, an unknown factor was about to be introduced. The temperature was about 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and a strong wind chill burned our skin. Picture eight boys sitting upright, two of them at their front steering positions, the others, their woolen mitten hands, either grasping the body in front or clutching the handrails on the side of each sled, legs wedged alongside of the person in front, all leaning into the momentum of the race. Adrenaline ran high in each boy, and we scarcely felt the tears stinging down our cheeks, our dripping noses, or the ear flaps of our caps whipping about with our ever-increasing speed. We were traveling, side by side, one on each side of the road. Just as we were nearing Curry's place, a dog ran out barking at the lights speeding toward him. Swerving around the animal, the driver nearly upset everyone on the sleigh, and this caused much yelling and cursing. That interception gave our sleigh the advantage, and we shot past them like a cannonball. We were winning. Howls of jubilation filled the air. Now the competition lagged by 20 feet. Meanwhile, another unknown factor was making his way up North Broadview. Charlie Murray had just got off work from the hospital and was pushing his bicycle up the road to visit his sweetheart, Peggy Ritchie. Upon hearing a lot of yelling and spotting a single light coming rapidly toward him, Charlie suspected kids sleigh riding, so he crossed to the other side of the road. The safe side, so he thought. If there was a light on his bike, it was not visible to the oncoming sleighs. Lloyd Reed, the steers person on my sled, the lightless sleigh, did not see the man pushing his bicycle toward us on our side of the road. He had no idea we were on a collision course. It was the headlights of a vehicle pulling out onto the road a half a mile ahead that caught our immediate attention. Suddenly, a dark form loomed up out of nowhere. Crash! At that instant, our bobsled hit the bicycle and man, causing them to become airborne. They spiraled above us as if in slow motion. Boys' bodies were thrown off the sleigh in all directions. The other bobsleigh heard the collision and headed for the ditch, scattering its crew all over the road. When the calamity finally cleared, there was only one casualty, Lloyd. A spoke from the crumpled bicycle wheel had pierced his leg and was sticking out of it like a spear. Luckily, Charlie was only shaken up and bruised, but otherwise unhurt. He unleashed a series of profanities at us before he regained his composure and limped his way up to his beloved sweetheart's house. His bicycle, totally wrecked, lay abandoned by the side of the road. Fortunately, Fred Damon Sr., who lived nearby, administered first aid to Lloyd by cutting the spoke off. He pulled out the remaining piece of spoke with a pair of pliers, dressed the wound, and bound up the leg. Reluctantly, we straggled home, pulling Lloyd on the sleigh. All were scared of what fate awaited us at home. Our night's adventure, once revealed to our parents, would totally ban any further bobsled escapades. Charlie's wrecked bicycle was abandoned at Damon's place for a few years until Fred Sr. and one of the boys' fathers decided to repair it. This they did, giving it to one of the young boys who survived that sleigh riding incident. He related the tale for many years to come and rode the evidence to show for it.
Long time ago, before the bay got its name of Salmon Arm, the valley was rife with fish, game, and plants. The place must have teemed with animals with only their natural predators to worry about. When the First Nations came to this valley, they were probably in awe with the lushness of the valley. There were acres and acres of various berries. The supilali, or foam berries, covered the valley and hillsides. The Sweatmuck name for the foam berry was Squitzmelt and gave its name to the local bands. There are many species of berries that grow here, which were harvested and sun-dried for winter use. The Shuswap people had a name for every part of the valley. If you were told of a certain place, you would know exactly where to find something or someone. I can remember just a couple of them now. Cald Hill has two mountains. One was called Big Otter and the other one Little Otter. Engineer's Point was known as Fox's Den, and Mount Ida was named from a strange colored rock found only there. The Shuswap names can be real tongue twisters. Sweatmuk Jean is not your first language. Since the coming of Christianity, the Shuswap names disappeared. According to archaeologists, there was prescribed burning to keep the berries flourishing in the area. The burning kept the competition of taller plants from taking over. Now our people have become too dependent on local stores for our food, and we don't harvest the traditional crops. When the government placed us on small reserves, it severely limited our travels to our traditional hunting and gathering areas. As more and more settlers moved in and claimed the land, the fewer places we had to gather. When the Indian agent came through and told us where we had to live, our life changed almost overnight. Our original reserve ran from McGuire Lake to 10th Avenue near what is known as Shoemaker's Corner. The reserve boundary ran from there all along 10th to Christensen Road over at the bottom of Cult Hill and back to McGuire Lake. Driving along 10th with my old Uncle Bill, he told me that 10th used to be the main highway. It made sense to me that the highway would bypass the reserve. Some or another, nobody really knows for sure, our reserve was pushed back to where it is today, and we started losing our land to the settlers. My granduncle Pierre Rees traveled to England in the early 1920s to petition the Crown. He was told quite curtly that all jurisdiction had been handed to the Canadian government. To this day, we don't know how we lost so much of our reserve. Our people relied heavily on the salmon run, not only for food, but it was also our currency. We traded dried salmon for things we couldn't make or gather here. Salmon was so abundant in rivers and creeks. My grandmother told me of the times when the sockeye first ran in Nepal. There were so many, they pushed the river back upstream. The local farmers would back their wagons into the river and pitchfork the salmon out. They would then spread them on their fields as fertilizer. It had been claimed you could walk across a river during the run and not get your feet wet. It was part of our culture to give the firstborn son to the grandparents to raise. My brother Harold was given to my paternal grandparents and was raised by them. I believe this custom developed so that adopted sons could take care of their grandparents when they became too fragile to care for themselves. I was the second eldest, so I was given to my maternal grandparents. My paternal grandparents kept Harold with them, and he grew up apart from the rest of his siblings. My paternal grandparents were a little more compassionate and allowed me to return home for a while if I became too lonesome. I enjoyed my life with my grandparents, though. They took good care of me. I recall on one occasion when I was about 4 or 5, my grandfather took me spearfishing. He had a catwalk along the river, and he speared fish from it. He showed me how and gave me a spear. On my first attempt, I speared too close to the tail, swam away, dragging me with it. The only way I could keep it was to jump in the river and run after it. My grandfather laughed till he cried. My grandmother scolded him for not helping me, and he said, quite rightly, that I had to learn the hard way. I got the salmon, though. I was very proud of myself. When I finally fell asleep next to the fire, I still had the fish beside me. As I got older and stronger and much more practiced, I became very adept at spearfishing. Sometimes in the mid-50s, my cousin and myself decided to go fishing, and my dad and Charlie Williams sat in the car to watch us fish. By then, our people had been banned from fishing, and the fish warden caught us. We refused to let go of our spears. The warden told us he was going to fetch the RCMP. While he was gone, we all left, but later my dad and Charlie were arrested for fishing. They went to court and fought the charge, claiming that fishing was their traditional right. They lost and were each fined $35. That was a lot of money back then. But it wasn't only us Wapmucks were good fishermen. I had a dog, a German Shepherd cross, called Teddy. He used to catch salmon. It was a sight to see. When he would dunk his whole head in the water and drag a salmon to shore, he would sit next to it, panting and dripping water everywhere. I'm sure I saw him smile in his own accomplishment more than a few times. Sadly, the salmon have all disappeared now. Only the memory remains. One day even that will disappear. There were so few that I stopped fishing many years ago, especially when I saw the flesh was gray. I was told the gray color was only because the water was too warm. I believe it was signs that the days of the great salmon run had come to an end. Oh! When I tell people that I would often catch over 200 salmon in one night and have them all up and on the drying racks, they don't believe me. Now people get all excited when they see one or two salmon in the river and talk like the salmon have returned. They haven't. In the late 1800s or early 1900s, our people knew times were changing. Their travel had been restricted and the monetary system was dying. The salmon trade had all but disappeared instead of hunting and gathering as our parents and long line of ancestors had. They instead had to clear the land using pick, shovel and axe, using horses to pull out stumps. One way of life was over and another had begun. But even with so much change, bitterness and resentment dragged its heels. A lot of bartering went on between the Suwakmek and the early settlers. My grandmother once told me they bartered a great deal with the Finlanders who had settled in the area and is now Glen Eden. She had a root cellar filled with dried meat, fish and berries. The Finns came over salt, butter, sugar, sometimes coffee or tea. She told them, "Go ahead, help yourself. You know what you want." She never stood over them watching. There was a lot of mutual trust. Some of my uncles used to go around with the Finns. I remember one time my Uncle Bill telling my grandmother they had been to a sauna and described to her what a sauna was. When he was done, my grandmother said, "Oh, they must be part Indian. I guess a sauna is similar in many ways to a sweat lodge." Sometimes in the 1940s, Finns started using dynamite or stumping powder to blow out big tree stumps. My mother told me that when they lit the dynamite, someone would shout, "Fire in the hole!" And everybody had to lie flat on the ground. It was noisy, but it sure made land clearing a lot easier. We used to help the farmers at hang time, too. I once found a dictionary dating from 1922 with the name Alexis Purdeby written on it. He was Suwakmek. I was surprised because at that time all the children were being sent to Kamloops Residential School. I showed it to my mother and she told me that farmers used to pull some strings to keep the young lads on the land to help with the haying. These children went to Salmon Arm West School. For those children who had to go to a residential school, a cattle truck would meet them outside the Catholic church on the reserve and they would have to stand in the back all the way to Kamloops. Those times the truck hadn't even been swept clean or back then the roads were not the roads we have today. The journey would take several hours and would be very uncomfortable in the trunk bumping along over the ruts and washouts. I was too young at the time to really understand why they were being taken away. I thought they might have been bad. Everyone would be crying, children and mothers. I would cry too, even though I didn't know what I was crying about. Now I am a father and can imagine the pain the parents must have felt watching their babies being driven off in the back of a cattle truck. Our homes became very quiet without the sounds of children playing and laughing. Our people were very superstitious and believed in spirits both good and bad. My cousins were always being ghosted. My grandmother would smudge the house. She was also a devout Catholic, and after smudging the house with sage in the traditional way, she would bring out the holy water. We would laugh and say she had double whammy to spirits. Since the introduction of Catholicism, our tradition ways were eradicated. We're seen as the work of the devil. In fact, the first church was being built on the reserve. Our medicine man offered to donate some of his logs to the building. The priest refused because anything that came from medicine man was unholy. Our medicine men and women were very important people before the churches came. Even after so many of our people became entrenched in the Catholic way, our medicine remained for quite a while. One particular story stands out in my mind. A man was kicked in the leg by a horse and became infested. It was so bad that the gangrene set in. At the time, the town doctors used to visit the reserve from time to time, and he told his man to make his peace with his maker, as he had little time left. The last two medicine women of the Suwakmek people came from Squilix, heard about this man's problems and sent for him. The woman made the poultice and put it on his wound and buried him up to his neck for 4 days and four nights. He was dug out of the ground, his wound had healed, he was sent back home. A couple of months later, the same doctor who had told him that nothing could be done was quite surprised to see him chopping wood outside his home. Yet the priest insists that our medicinal knowledge was the work of the devil. It was the same for our language and legends that had been handed down through the generations. We had mythical animals, water monsters, Sasquatch and little people, all devil work. My favorite legend is the story of the little people of Mount Ida, Glasgow. There was famine across the land and the people were starving. One day a hunter climbed Glasgow hoping to find something to eat for his people. After days of searching, he finally fell to the ground exhausted and frustrated. Some hours later, he awoke to find he was surrounded by the little people. They asked him why he was on their mountain and he replied that his people were hungry and he had come looking for food. The little people huddled around in conversation for a while and then their leader addressed the hunter and said, "Your people are hungry because you disrespected the land. You take and give nothing in gratitude. This has made Mother Earth angry and she has hidden the food from you. Mend your ways and your people no longer be welcome to live with the Mother Earth." The hunter watched in awe as the little people faded back into the mountains. He heard what they had given him. So he built a sweat lodge and sweated for 4 days and four nights, prayed to the Mother Earth and gave thanks for all her gifts. As he was climbing down the mountain, he came across a herd of deer. Using his skill with his bow and arrow, he shot one of the deer, taking care not to let it suffer. He removed his liver and heart and took them back to his people. He gave thanks for his food. He returned to the people, and after they feasted, he told them that the little people and what they taught him. From that day on, the hunters would always return to Glasgow before a hunt and sweat for 4 days and four nights. And the women, whenever they gathered berries and roots or medicine, always gave an offering of thanks. Beginning of every gathering season, the whole Squapmuc Nation would gather at Kamloops. They would visit and catch up with all their news, arrange betrothals, and get married. The gathering would last for as long as 2 weeks before the people dispersed to begin another year of hunting and gathering. At the end of the season, the nation would meet again, share their bounties, gamble, sing, dance, and give thanks to the harvest for returning to their coulees in the long winter. Over time, this gathering moved to Salmon Valley, in part because there has been so much intermarriage between the Squapmuc and Okanagan. By the time I came along, the world and the life of my ancestors had changed. My whole world was the reserve boundary. The Salmon River, its delta, the Glen Eden Hills was my playground. Occasionally, we would travel to pick berries or harvest roots, but not the way my parents had. By the mid-1950s, very few people smoked fish or meat. There were few, if any, dried berries. By then our people had their own little farms with big gardens, chickens, pigs. It became more convenient to shop locally and our men started taking jobs logging or working in the sawmills. The closest mill on the reserve was owned by Calkey and Lawrence, just below the Salmon River Bridge, and later another one on Palmer's Creek. By around 1952, Native children were allowed to attend regular school. My eldest brother and sister were the first Shuswapmuk to attend school in town. My school career began the following year. We had to walk to Hedgeman's Corner to catch the bus. The following year, 1954, Salmon Arm West Elementary was open. We walked to school, uphill both ways. Up until then, we had very little contact with non-Natives except for the Finns. We learned very quickly which stores and businesses refused to serve Natives. We were not even allowed to go to the hospital. My mother was in labor with twins. She was refused help. If it hadn't been for a compassionate cab driver and the generosity of the Enderby Hospital, my premature twin brothers may not have lived quite a few years for the mutual acceptance to develop. Our people continue to try to maintain our old ways in the technological world. It is not the easiest of tasks. We didn't have an opportunity to evolve from hunter-gatherers to settled farmers in towns or cities. The Industrial Revolution was not part of our history. Out of necessity, we have jumped from family clans living day to day in harmony with our surroundings to a fast-paced post-industrial age in less than three generations. Can we be forgiven for not always understanding the ways of others? Can we forgive ourselves for wanting the benefits that today's world has to offer, yet still mourn the loss of our culture? We are still trying to bridge that gap. I have my own sweat lodge and I use it often. When I am inside cocooned in the warmth of the grandfather's sock, rocks and darkness of the mother's womb, I meditate on all the changes I have seen. The first TV, Elvis, a man walking on the moon, wars and economic crashes. So much change, yet what have we gained? The salmon have left us. Many of our animal cousins, the vast forests have been depleted and water barely trickled from the mountains. I wonder what the world will look like to my grandchildren. And I think back to the past, to the time of my ancestors living on this land. I hear their laughter echoing through the valley and rustling through the trees. Perhaps all will be well. Ukcham, Louis Thomas.
A long time ago, before the coming of Christmas, the Sequopmik children celebrated all winter long, when the bands of Sequopmik retired to their traditional winter homes in the fall time. Every evening, the children would get all warm and snuggly in their blankets of fur. They would wait in anticipation for an evening of fun and lots of laughter. It would start off with most likely silly things that happened during the day, or some great hunting feat. Then the drumming and singing would start up, with the fire casting an eerie glow. Some dancer pantomiming a hunter's feat, or describing a battle with one of the neighboring tribes. The evening would end up with a professional storyteller, or someone who was well-versed in telling of the legend of Chiptaquila. Chiptaquila was a way of teaching the children right from wrong. Grandma, or Kia'a, would sneak some treat-like dried huckleberry for a late-night snack. The children would finally sleep and dream of fighting wild animals, or finding acres and acres of big juicy berries, or dreaming good dreams of what tomorrow will bring. Chief Atom School, Sequopmik Language Immersion School, situated on the Adams Lake Band near Chase, B.C., the school was founded in 1991 and grounded in the belief that knowledge of language and traditional practices will help develop a strong, healthy community. In 1987, a small group of parents from Adams Lake, Nisqually, and Little Shuswap worked together to start a Sequopmik immersion program from birth to 5 years old. Today, hundreds of children have been immersed in the Sequopmik language and culture, and have contributed to the revival of the Sequopmik language. We have Sequopmik children and language teachers from Chief Atom School singing, "Today a Baby is Born."
Binis kutachach at the scream amen. La asram and tenkat kubi. Yvi es paps, the moves a thousand lasu. Es chikam is a yen a scream amen. Bin is good to have. heart will scream and bleed. Let us lament and proud could be. Redoubts us from quaint, my work was achieved. We sat as Janet Burdes. Redoubts us from quaint, my work was achieved. Till and greenest work was just now. Binis kulta khachat l'skrim amble Jack was a pushman from white a kamu Binis kulta khachat l'skrim amble La
Virginia Basil was born December 27, 1938, passed away October 10, 2005. She was a longtime resident of Splatson Band in Enderby, B.C. She was 7 years old when she had TB. She was placed at the Kokolitsa Hospital in Sardis for 7 years. When she came home at the age of 14, she had a passion for her language, which she studied from her grandmother. Virginia took a certified language training course with Betty Arnous in Penticton, B.C. She went wherever they had hired her to teach the language. The places she taught was Round Lake Treatment Center, Shahihia School, daycare at Splatson Band in Enderby. And she taught at the school district number 83. She pretty well spent her remaining years at Chief Atom School. She took great pride in her language and always had a great sense of humor. She touched everyone she met and leave a legacy we will always remember. Here we have Virginia singing Jingle Bells and Tsuhwap McCheen.
Dow, 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 will my yams. Buckled wheel, the Sakamoon, the Kuska hot little sleep. Oh, dow, 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 will my yams. Buckled wheel, the Sakamoon, the Kuska hot little sleep. Quantless darkness woo, Nikoska hot little sleep. Oh, you look less tired, where quiet will lie out. Ha 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 ha. Start you back, la 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 la, chich a ho quai. A wheel that took ya, chich a jean and a song. Oh, dew, 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 will my yell. Buckled wheel, the sycamore, the crispa hot in the sleep.
White, yeah, white up, Achao, Louis Thomas. I've had a few people come and ask me how our people celebrated the holidays in the past. I told them that the little people on Klaskant or Mount Ida made presents for all the little ones, and the coyote delivered the presents in a large birch bark basket. I think then they realized that there was no such thing as Christmas a long time ago. Just listening to my kia and sla or grandparents and elders talking of the past made me think of how our people celebrated holidays in the winter. From what my grandmother and other elders said was that our big celebrations were at the end of the seasons and beginning. All the bands and outlying areas all met at certain places like Kamloops and had a huge celebration. At the beginning of the year, they would bring leftover food to contribute to the feast. The feast would last for maybe 2 weeks or until the food ran out. When it was over, the separate bands would go to their traditional hunting and gathering areas. It was the same for the end of the hunting and gathering season. There were other celebrations such as first berries or first coming of the salmon. Our people spent all winter long in pit houses or chisgisten, and every evening was like Christmas. Winter villages consisted of many pit houses, and visitors were always welcome every evening. The agenda for the evening was usually started off with a big meal and ended with a fruit delicacy. Chiptakula, or storytelling, started the evening, finishing with drumming, singing, and dancing. And if they were lucky, a professional storyteller was visiting. He traveled all over the lands and collected legends and stories. The people paid him in food and clothing and a warm bed for as long as he stayed. The tired children would be nestled in their fur blankets, watching the parents and elders' shadows dancing off the walls and half listening to tales of great feats from warriors and hunters. Every evening was a lesson for children to aspire to greatness for their people. Today we have adapted and accepted new way of life, celebrating Christmas, New Year's, like everyone else, because it is about sharing and mostly gift-gifting to our children. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to all. Kuk Cham.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceofthesuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.